That's working, and where's the button on this one? Little red button. Hold it in. And the light goes on, right? Can you hear me now? Is it working? It takes a minute. Okay. Can you hear me now? Okay. Welcome. My name is David Kramer. I am a professor here at JTS, but for tonight's purposes, more importantly, I am the librarian, the director of the library of JTS, and it is our pleasure to sponsor this book talk this evening. We offer a series of these through the year, both of authors who happen to be JTS faculty and others who have published books that we feel might be of interest to the community. And so we'll invite you back for those as well. Tonight, as you can see, there is an excellent turnout, which is testimony both to the quality of the scholarship produced by the author, and seeing many of the faces here, the many, many friends and students of the author who also are here. So it's a tribute to you, Bert, that there is such a turnout. It's a pleasure to be able to have you all here for what will be a wonderful presentation. Books will be sold later, and you will hear from Bert why it is worth purchasing those books. But I'd like to begin by saying a few words of introduction. Before the formal introduction of the book, actually, let me remind you to turn off your cell phones or at least silent them. You won't have any reason to get bored, I assure you, but if you find your eyes wandering and see that clock, you will know that it's wrong. Okay? It's 5 minutes later than that. And the reason I say that is because we do our best to finish these events after about an hour, at which point there will be, I think the formal term I was asked to use was collation, is that correct? A collation afterwards, some wine and other beverages along with snacks that are sponsored by Bird and his wife and by the library. We invite you to that after we are finished, and it is that occasion where Bert will be selling books for $20 a piece, and happy to sign them. Now, to the book itself, I give the title, even though you all know it from our promotion, so that people who listen to this online will know exactly what we're talking about. The author, of course, is Bert Posatsky. The book is Aphrodite and the Rabbis, How the Jews Adopted Roman Culture to Create Judaism as We Know It. I could say a whole number of things about this book, but I'm going to leave Bert to deal with the substance. I just want to make one observation. Some of you who are also friends of mine know that I have a practice of, I have a chavruta. Chavruta is a study partnership that I've had with my mother, who lives in California, for about 3 years. We speak every work day that my schedule permits. I give her a call and we study something together. And for a long time, she's been saying, I really want to understand how this rabbinic Judaism began. How did it happen? How did Judaism come to be what we know? And we've been studying primary texts, which has been wonderful. She actually found recently, we finished one of the epistles written by Paul, which says, oh, now I understand Judaism of the first century. It was actually one of the best insights she got. But for the longest time, I didn't have anything that I could recommend to her that would be both responsible from the perspective of the latest scholarship and accessible as, being written in a language that wasn't this obscure academese, which academics write in order to make sure that you can't read their books. So that's the problem. Until I sat down with this volume in preparation for my introduction, and I discovered, wow, I finally have the book. So I can tell you that tomorrow, I am going to recommend to my mother that the next thing we study together is Aphrodite and the Rabbis. I'm quite sure that she will say yes. And Bert, I'm going to need a signed copy to send to her. Last time I did this was with Ray Shenlin's book, which she also loved. Okay, so welcome all, and I now introduce the author, Bert Vysotsky.
Thank you. It's really quite wonderful to be here in a room full of friends, people I know from many different parts of my life. It's especially gratifying that my niece Julia is here. I reminded her that the last time she was in this room was just about 20 years ago when I got married to Sandy, because this is the seminary synagogue when it's not doubling as a lecture space. It was just the perfect place for us to be wed. In addition to everything else that Sandy does for me, she is my first and last reader. And you know, great is the married couple where the wife can say, no, you really need to get rid of that line. And I've really learned to listen. So thank you, Sandy, publicly for all that you do every day. I should give everyone kind of fair warning. The last couple of years, I have not had a high holiday congregation. Rosh Hashanah is next week, and you're all here. Short of me saying, will the congregation please rise, you're going to hear me hold forth. What I want to talk about is not read from the book, but talk about how the book came to be and what partly motivated it and what motivated me. And in order to do that, I have to share a little bit of my sabbatical life. The last two sabbaticals I've had, in 2014 and before that in 2007, it actually works that way, every 7 years we have a sabbatical, I had the privilege of teaching at a pontifical university in Rome. So the first thing I should say is it's a great gig if you can get it. In 2007, I had the lofty title of the Master Visiting Professor of Jewish Studies at the Pontifical Gregorian University. I should point out that's a Jesuit university. It's actually where Pope Francis attended. And I am still grateful to Richard and Susan Master, who gave the money for the professorship and gave me that kind of neat title to be the Master Visiting Professor. You know, their name could have been Schwartz, and I would have been the Schwartz Visiting Professor, but now it sounds much more impressive. In 2014, I was at what's called the Angelicum, the Pontifical University of St. Thomas Aquinas, which is a Dominican university. And this is really kind of an interesting thing to me, that these two papal universities that train priests, that train doctoral students, that literally have Catholics come from all over the world, each of them has a small but significant Jewish studies program. And I think it's not accidental that those two, the Jesuits and the Dominicans, were really pretty good at persecuting the Jews throughout the Middle Ages. And now, they are, since Vatican II, I think doing some teshuva. They are repenting in a very serious way. They take Vatican II seriously, it's now the 50th anniversary, and they want their students, their priests, to know not just Jewish history and Jewish texts, but to know it from Jews. This said, it also helps to be in Rome, to be working for the Vatican, because the Vatican can open doors that simply are otherwise closed. And it is about the opening of those doors that I want to talk to you now. Because both in 2007 and in 2014, I was able to go visit the catacombs. So first let me ask, in this room, how many of you have visited Rome? Wow. And of those of you who visited Rome, how many of you have visited the catacombs? Okay, now, of those of you who have visited the catacombs, how many of you visited the Jewish catacombs? A professor of classics, no less. There's a reason for that. The Christian catacombs down on the Via Appia, the catacomb of San Callisto or St. Priscilla, Those were are maintained by the Vatican, by the Catholic community. They paid for those catacombs to be lighted, to be buttressed, to be ventilated, and perhaps most important, to be sanitized. So they are truly ready for prime time. Literally, probably a million tourists go through them every year. The only thing you have to fear in the Christian catacombs is a bit of claustrophobia, going under the ground into a former burial chamber. The Jewish community of Rome is much, much smaller and doesn't have the kind of resources, which should be obvious to you, that the Vatican does. And for a long time, pre-Vatican II, the Vatican was not encouraging Jewish tourism in Rome. So the Jewish catacombs are a whole nother story. They are not ventilated. They are, as a result, very moist, humid air. They are not well lit. They are not clean. When I say not clean, I don't mean that you're walking on dirt. I mean there are still skeletons in the Jewish catacombs. Inside the wall chambers, the kochs, as they're called, these hewn chambers, in the very porous, soft tufa stone, that's where they would put a body, and they would either seal it over with cement, or they would leave the body to decay. When the body had totally decayed, if they sealed it over, that chamber is then called a sarcophagus, literally a flesh eater. And then a year later or so, the family would come back and do reburial and take the bones and put them in an ossuary, which is smaller, a little more intimate, and takes up a lot less room. So it was actually a pretty efficient mode of burial. Jews and Christians buried their dead in Rome that way, probably from the very late first century, certainly the second, third, and fourth century of the Common Era. So we're talking about 1800 years ago. With a, there's no polite way to say this. I pulled out a wad of euros and managed to convince someone it was in their interest that I should be allowed to visit the Jewish catacombs. I was told just how large that wad had to be and whose hand to put it into. I had an enabler, and I did it. And the priest that did it, actually, I just got an email from him today. He did his doctorate at Columbia, so we know each other for a long, long time, and he made these arrangements for me. I was taken in 2007 to the catacomb, the entrance of which is underneath Mussolini's villa. And my tour guide for that occasion was the municipal electrician who once a month or so walks through the catacombs to make sure that none of the wires that were strung during the re-excavation in Mussolini's time have shorted out so there wouldn't be an underground fire. So you have to imagine me all suited up, having dutifully shaken hands with this guy with a lot of cash in it and vanished like that. And he gives me a miner's cap, right, a hard hat with a lamp on it. And then he gives me a lantern to carry. And he says, "You want gloves?" I said, "Ah, no, I don't need gloves." Not a good decision. And in we go. It's very, very dark. It's very, very humid. They literally don't ventilate, so they won't let you stay down there for more than an hour. And it is a catacomb. So, you know, you're in this maze, and I'm terrified that I'm going to get lost. So I never wanted him to get too far ahead of me. But after all, he had a headlamp. I had a headlamp. Wasn't going to be too bad. But there was interesting stuff down there. Graves. Graves with inscriptions. Technically, inscriptions on the wall are called graffiti. Right? There it is, graffiti. But some of them were actual inscriptions on marble. I guess fancier families could afford marble, and they would place them into the wall. We turn one corner, we turn another corner, I see one koch, another koch, and the first sign, I see a menorah. The menorahs are ubiquitous. Everywhere you go, there is incised menorahs. There are painted menorahs. There are frescoed menorahs. There are, and I find this ironic, clay lamps with menorahs on them. So you know you're in Jewish turf. Next to the menorah, there's often kind of primitively drawn a lulav, an etrog, a shofar, exactly the symbols you would grow to expect. Some of the symbols we might expect, like a six-pointed Jewish star, way too early for that. That was not one of their symbols. And then the names. The names are all written there. Good old-fashioned inscriptions. All, hey, we're in Rome, in Latin and Greek. All in Latin and Greek. How do I know, aside from the symbols, that they're Jewish? They're often biblical names. So if someone is, in Hebrew, we would say Ben Shimon. There it would say Simonides. You have to know how to translate. And it's a little bit like going from Hebrew to English. If you have a Hebrew name and an English name, you know, you want, like my mother was always annoyed that I named my daughter after my late father. My father's name was Meir. And I named my daughter Leora because they both share the root or, light. But my mother, who was not a Hebraica, said, but there's no M in the name, right? So the Roman Jews did the same thing. Reuven was Rufus. Binyamin, for a lot of complicated reasons, was Alexander. My son is named Alexander in both English and in Hebrew. Solved the problem. So, in fact, as is my daughter, her English name is Leora, and her Hebrew name is Leora. Just move the accent a little. So I'm there, and I see graves, I see inscriptions, and then I notice the first skeleton. A little creepy. I quietly put my hand in my pocket, which was dopey because now I've taken it off the wire and I might lose the electrician. I grew up in the 70s, 60s, and there was a comedy group that had a thing called Waiting for the Electrician or someone like him. Right? That's what I felt like underground. I was waiting for the electrician or someone like him. And we go, and then there's another corpse, and yet another corpse, and yet another corpse. Full skeletons! Skulls, backbones, rib cages, the whole thing. I can't resist. And I touched the skeleton. I almost leapt out of my skin. Because I had every expectation that it would be petrified. It would be hard. But it wasn't, not in that humidity. It was spongy. So my finger actually kind of went into the bone. I really didn't want the electrician to know that I had poked at it, but I was just so, I was just trembling. Trying to keep the tears back. I'm kind of emotional, if you know me. In any case, that's not such a hard thing. But there I am, and the way I calm myself, because I am a scholar and I am who I am, is I like to read. So I'm catching up to the electrician, reading name after name after name after name after name of Jews buried 1800 years ago. And from somewhere deep inside me, seeing one name after another, I realize I'm in a Jewish cemetery. These are, as it were, headstones. And somewhere I stop, I read the name, and I begin, El Malei Rachamim, Shochein Bamramim. I happen to know the memorial prayer by heart. I went from grave to grave, singing El Malei Rachamim. I am getting emotional because even now, it certainly is in the top three of religious experiences I've had in my life. I don't know where it came from. I knew it was the right thing to do. There were tears coming down my cheeks, and then the electrician heard me singing, turned around, and there were tears on his cheeks as well, because he got it. I didn't have to translate the Hebrew for him. So I went, made my way through. We got to some beautiful chambers. We saw some beautiful frescoes, but I saw some beautiful dead Jews underground in Rome. And I was able to pray that their soul be bound up in the bond of eternal life. I did this in 2007, so for sure I was going to repeat it in 2014. I went to a different catacomb this time. I went with a group. I went with a group of two Hungarians from the Institute for European Education, the IEEE something. If you've ever traveled abroad, you might have done something with them. And one of my best friends in the whole world, who is Jewish. So two Christians, two Jews, and a little old Jewish lady who literally lived through World War II, is a partisan, and she is an archaeologist. She just retired, and she took us through the catacomb. And once again, when we got to the chamber, I asked everybody if they would indulge me, and we said El Malei Rachamim again, and everybody said Amen, and again, it was a very moving experience. But then I got thinking about the Jews. Who were they? Right, I knew their names, and they all had Latin and Greek. By the way, virtually no Hebrew whatsoever down there. The only word visible in either catacomb that I could readily make out was Shalom. Okay, Shalom. So we said Shalom, and the more I thought about it, the less I knew. My question to myself was, these are Jews who lived in Rome. It wasn't the land of Israel. Now, it's true that there are stories in the Talmud, in rabbinic literature, that talk about how the rabbis might have visited Rome. But I always take those a little bit with a grain of salt, even though I happen to be a rabbi who visited Rome. But I kind of figure it was different back then. And of the inscriptions that talk about what the Roman Jews might expect after death, the most common inscription went something like, I lived, I died, that's all there is. Which, for those of you who actually know the Jewish prayer book, you may realize is not what rabbinic Jews believe. We actually believe in bodily resurrection of the dead, maybe sometime in the messianic future, but that's what we pray for three times a day. So I began to wonder, would these Roman Jews, first of all, they wouldn't have understood the Hebrew I was singing. Second of all, they might have wondered, what the hell's a rabbi? Third of all, they would have said, what are you talking about, life hereafter, the bond of eternal life? We don't believe that stuff. On the other hand, some of the pagan philosophers actually do believe in the eternality of the soul. So they might have thought it was nice. They might have thought it was a good sentiment. And they might have heard at least something that sounded familiar to them, because they might have once heard some Hebrew, like the word shalom. And this is the problem that began to kind of possess me in a very powerful way. To what extent is rabbinic Judaism kind of coterminous with the Judaism that was found everywhere else in the Roman Empire? And while we're at it, were the Jews of the land of Israel so unique, or were they in fact like their brethren, and the rabbis are the unusual guys? I'm fond of telling my students that if you took all the rabbis we know from rabbinic literature, the stuff that David Kramer teaches and I teach, and we counted up any given generation of rabbis, there are probably fewer rabbis in any given generation of classical rabbinic Judaism than there are at JTS on any given afternoon. They were really a remarkably small movement. So what was their influence? What was their power? And to what extent did Roman culture influence rabbinic Judaism? Now, it should be obvious to you that an American Jew would ask this question. Here I am, my version of Judaism is very American. You look at me, and but for the yarmulke on my head, I could be teaching anything, anywhere. Right? I'm looking around the room. There are professors who do Jewish stuff who teach all over, and we don't look that different than anyone else, at least I would prefer to think. And we don't believe that different, and the way we do Judaism, this is an institution, JTS, that has been ordaining women 35 years. It has been ordaining gays and lesbians going on 10 years. I mean, we live in the modern social construct of America, an emphatically Christian country, and yet it shapes who we are as Jews. So I wanted to know, was that true in antiquity? So really the question is, just how much Greek and Roman influence is there in rabbinic literature? Now, I happen to know, because my Talmud professor, a man who was born in Eastern Europe in the town of Motala, who went to the Slobodka Yeshiva, who I happened to study with when he was in his 80s. He wrote two books. One was called Greek in Jewish Palestine, and the other Hellenism in Jewish Palestine. And by rough count, Professor Lieberman, may he rest in peace, assumed there were somewhere between 3 and 4,000 loan words from Greek and Latin in rabbinic literature, neatly transliterated into Hebrew letters. Let me give you some examples. We are in a synagogue. Nice Greek word. Jewish courts are called the Sanhedrin. So Christians know from the Sanhedrin, it's mentioned in the New Testament. Jews know the Sanhedrin, it's mentioned throughout rabbinic literature. Romans knew the Sanhedrin, it's what they called the Roman Senate. Let me give you another example by display. Now I'm on the Bima. Thank you. Right? We all think Bima because there is a biblical Hebrew word, Bama, which means a high place. So you get called up to the Torah, you go up to the Bima. But the truth is, it's actually a Greek loan word. Bema means where you rise up. It's the riser where the judge sits. It's what you ascend to for a fancy meal. It's the dais, if you will. So again, another loan word. We have all of these loan words. I wanted to contextualize this seasonally. And I confess to you, if it were before Passover, I could tell you all about the Greco-Roman background of the Seder. Seder and Symposium. I actually do the tap dance. And some of you who have been at my Seder have heard it ad nauseum. But it's before Rosh Hashanah. So I decided I would take an example from Rosh Hashanah. And I particularly like the example because it involves a very dear memory of my late father. When I was a kid in Chicago, my father, in the week or two before Rosh Hashanah, would almost skip around the house. And in a bizarre falsetto voice, would sing the words, Haben Yakir Li Ephraim. Ephraim is a dear son to me. Why did my father sing in falsetto? Because when he was a child, he was part of the All Chicago Children's Choir. And he sang backup to the great cantor Yesala Rosenblatt. So my father, every year, would relive this experience by going back into falsetto for a short while. And for those of you that know the phrase, Haben Yakir Li Ephraim, it's from the prophet Jeremiah, and it's actually the prophetic reading, the Haftorah, on the second day of Rosh Hashanah. So I have this very fond memory, and indeed my father, if he could finagle it, would chant the Haftorah, would chant that portion in the synagogue. But it's an odd locution. Ephraim is a dear son to me. Who's Ephraim? I mean, so, okay, Ephraim was, he's Joseph's son, is that right? So he's Jacob's grandson, he becomes one of the tribes. So is it the person Ephraim? Is it the tribe Ephraim? Is it the northern tribes that are sometimes called Ephraim? Or, and the or is what I'm interested in a midrash from the 5th century in the Galilee, Roman Galilee, two rabbis disagreed about the meaning of the term Ephraim. See, I'm going to give you some good stuff for Rosh Hashanah second day. You'll have something to think about while they're chanting the prophetic portion. Actually, I recommend you just take my book and read in the synagogue. You can tell why I don't have a synagogue for the holidays. In any case, two 3rd, 4th century rabbis, Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi and Rabbi Yehoshua ben Nechemia, they disagreed with one another about the meaning of Ephraim. Now, I'm quoting to you from the Hebrew text. Rabbi Yehoshua says, Ephraim, Palatiani. The other Rabbi Yehoshua says, Ephraim, Evgenostatos. Neither of those words are Hebrew. Palatiani, like the word palatial, those of the palace. Evgenostatos, Ev, so it's the EU beginning, like euphemism or euphonic, good. Genos, like generate, born, well born. Statos is the Greek superlative ending. Really well born. So here are two rabbis commenting on the Haftorah in a section of the Midrash that's actually commenting on Rosh Hashanah. And one says, oh, it's the guys of the palace, right? Those who have access to the king. And the other guy says, oh, no, it's the nobility. Both defining a term. So this really kind of caught me. It caught my fancy. That these are rabbis who may very well have prayed in Hebrew, but they thought in Greek. And that pushed me to even think further about who were the Jews who wrote the Midrash and the Talmud. What language did they use? What was their whole worldview? Because when you speak a language, it informs who you are. Those of you who go to Israel and visit, you know, you play the game of reading signs, and you know almost immediately that if there's way too many letters in the sign, it's going to be a loan word. Usually a loan word from English. You know, you're sounding out and it says televisia. Do I need to translate? You know, it'll say computers. Sometimes in the right neighborhood, you'll get a Russian word. But you see the hegemony of the other culture coming in and imposing itself. So here are rabbis who are speaking Greek. We have inscriptions from synagogues, from 50, 60 synagogues around the land of Israel. The majority of those inscriptions are in Greek. Greek is what they spoke in the eastern part of the empire. In the synagogue. Now, I say that, and I'm looking here in a synagogue, and any of you can think of your own synagogues, where there are inscriptions. So what are the inscriptions? What are they always? Donor plaques. By the way, that's true in the inscriptions in the land of Israel in the 5th century. And I have seen at least one scholar suggest that that was true in the first temple in Jerusalem in 500 BCE, that there were donor plaques. I mean, Jews are Jews. That's what's, you know, they're going to be donor plaques. But in our synagogues, donor plaques are by and large in English. They're in the lingua franca that we speak. Now, if it's a memorial plaque, someone died and you put up the plaque, you might have their name in Hebrew, you might have two letters in Hebrew, Zichrono Livracha, Zal, something like that. But again, English is used. So if someone dropped down from space and visited our synagogues, they would quickly figure out that we were English-speaking Jews who also used some Hebrew. And now if we would parachute in to the land of Israel, in the Galilee, in the 4th, 3rd, 5th century, and we read the donor plaques, we'd quickly come to the conclusion that they knew some Hebrew. They certainly had Aramaic because the other language of inscriptions was Aramaic. But by and large, they were Greek speakers. How much so? The Talmud, the Palestinian Talmud, the Talmud of the land of Israel, actually tells us that in one of the big towns in the synagogue, they recited the Shema, the quintessential Jewish prayer at the heart of our liturgy. They recited the Shema in Greek. It's interesting. The editor of Aphrodite, Elizabeth Dusegaard, is a Norwegian Christian. And when she read that they spoke Greek, she said, well, what's the big deal? Because she didn't grow up with the expectation that we all have, that if you're in the land of Israel and you're Jewish, you should speak Hebrew. And this was a mystery to her. Of course they spoke Greek. It was the Eastern Empire. That's the language. So we have that issue. I want to turn to two stories that will kind of give you an idea of the ways in which Greek culture, Greek art, Greek architecture pervade the Jewish world of antiquity. And in order to do that, I'm going to quite literally invoke my friend Aphrodite. I've gotten to know her quite well. She is the Roman goddess of love. And if you go to the Metropolitan Museum, in addition to now seeing that magnificent Jerusalem exhibit there through January 8th, you can also go and see an entire hall of Aphrodite statues. I went one day a few months ago and communed with her. I was kind of hoping I'd find a good image for my publicist, but it was a worthwhile visit. One of the great leaders of the Jewish community in the early 2nd century. He probably lived between 90 and 120. His name was Rabban Gamaliel. His grandfather is mentioned in the New Testament as the teacher of St. Paul. But our Gamaliel, Gamaliel the younger, if you will, was an interesting bird. He was apparently well enough Hellenized that he, like actually every citizen in Rome, went to the baths daily. People did not have bathtubs in their home. They certainly didn't have showers in their home. They couldn't afford running water. You needed an aqueduct to bring in the water, which meant you either had to be fabulously wealthy or you used what the city provided, the city aqueduct, which was often donated by someone fabulously wealthy. So the baths were a very public space, and Roman men bathed every day. They really were believers in cleanliness. The Roman baths were fairly straightforward. There was a cold pool, there was a tepid pool, there was a hot pool. We have found dozens, if not hundreds, of these baths around the land of Israel, including, of all places, on top of Mount Masada. But you know, you need your bath. So the story goes that Gamaliel, this is in the Mishnah, in the quintessential rabbinic document composed around the year 200 in the Galilee, the Mishnah tells the story of Gamaliel in the baths of Aphrodite. The baths of Aphrodite. Some non-Jew says to him, "Aren't you a rabbi? What are you doing in the baths of Aphrodite? She's a Roman goddess." Gamaliel, who's a very clever fellow, says, "You've asked me a question of Jewish law. I can't respond in the bath. It's inappropriate." "Wait till we're outside." They get dressed, they go outside, and Gamaliel says, "You know, I didn't come on her turf. She came on my turf. I've been bathing here a long time. And then all of a sudden, one day, there's a statue of Aphrodite. So now it's a temple?" He says, "What kind of pagan temple is this? You're standing there naked. You're peeing in front of her." That's actually what it says in the Mishnah. And then Gamaliel says something very smart. He says, "If it is an object for worship, well, then I'm forbidden to be here. But if it's art, I can enjoy it as well as the next guy." Now, I'm pushing a theory, which is that from that time onward, we begin to see pictorial art in Jewish archaeological sites. Before that, there's only geometric shape. After that, you start to see actual pictorial art. Within a century after Gamaliel, we see full wall paintings, like at the Synagogue of Dura Europus, of Jews. All the biblical characters are dressed in Roman garb, and all the non-Jewish characters from these biblical stories are dressed in Persian garb. Apparently the Persians were the bad guys in that synagogue. But it's quite astonishing. All of these guys with togas and himation, and none of them, by the way, have ritual fringes, no tzitzit, but all dressed very much in Roman garb. So Gamaliel gives us the first principle, that Jewish art is permissible, even art that depicts pagan gods and goddesses. Why is this important? Because today, if we were to go on the archaeological tour, we would find 5 synagogues in the Galilee that smack in the middle of the mosaic floor of the synagogue, there is a depiction of Zeus Helios. Can I tell you, there have probably been 10,000 articles written trying to figure out what the hell Zeus is doing on the floor of a synagogue. Everything from, "Oh, the Jews put it there so they could stomp on it," to, "Oh, you know, it was syncretistic." Should I use the word hermeneutic now? We have to trot out all the technical jargon, right? And then, you know, there's always the possibility, which really gnaws at me, that they just thought it was a nice picture and they, you know, like, "All right, so, you know, we'll get that one from the book and we'll put that on the floor." We're redoing our kitchen, so I'm used to, like, looking at all the books of pictures and like, "Okay, we want that." Although we don't have a Zeus yet. I tried to convince my daughter, who has a degree in art history and is an artist, that she should go into the business of laying Roman mosaics on floors. And she said, "Yeah, Dad, I'm going to spend the rest of my artistic career on my knees with cement between my fingers. Like, not going to happen." All right, so now we know that Gamaliel had the sense He knew that there was a Roman statuary. There's Roman statuary everywhere. So many of you have been to Rome, you know this. Everywhere you turn, there's a statue. They liked statuary. And so it was true in the baths as well. But then, Venus, Aphrodite, I'm going to call her by her nickname, Agape. Agape is the Greek word for love. So Agape, they call her the love goddess, Levi. There is a story, it's found in the earliest rabbinic commentary on the book of Numbers. It's repeated many times in rabbinic literature, and you'll understand why. It's got this kind of lovely locker room flavor. So the boys in the yeshiva could not resist retelling this narrative. It's a story about a prostitute. Eliot wanted to know, would there be sex? So here we go. There was a prostitute in the maritime cities who apparently charged 400 gold pieces as her price. Now, we don't need to do the whole Roman equivalence of how much is a gold piece. 400 gold pieces, it's a lot of money. A lot of money. This woman had to have been fabulous. Indeed, the young man, who, as we'll find out, turns out to be a rabbinical student, saves up his shekels, and he sends off his money to make an appointment to visit this hooker. The day comes, he's very excited, today's the day. He goes, he gets to the antechamber, and her maid says, come, take a seat, you're welcome here, we have your appointment. She goes in, she tells the prostitute, the guy's here. The prostitute says, I'm ready, send him in. He gets into the boudoir, and he finds 7 beds. The lower 6 are all of silver. Between each, there's a silver ladder, and she's at the 7th, at the very top, on the golden bed. The little ladder is referred to, sometimes it's a ladder, sometimes it's a bench. There's a Latin/Greek word for ladder bench, which is still used in modern Hebrew for a bench, safsal. Right? You all know that term, safsal? You know, when you were in camp, you had to move the benches from one place to another, safsalim. But it's the Latin Greek word subsellium, right? So there she is, arrayed at the top, buck naked, waiting for her appointment. The guy starts stripping off his clothing. He's clearly excited. And as he takes off his outer shirt, his tzitzit, his ritual fringes, smack him in the face. He's not only mortified, he's deflated. He climbs down all 7 ladders. He sits on the ground just, oh my God, I spent all this money and now I can't do it. What's going on? And the woman says, Agape shel Romi, by the love goddess of Rome. What blemish did you see in me? This has never happened to me before. He says to her, Ha'avodah, by the temple service, right? That means by the temple in Jerusalem and the sacrifices offered there. Mind you, the temple has already been destroyed a couple hundred years, which might be a commentary on his manhood at that moment, who knows? But he takes this vow, this very pious vow, by the temple service. I've never seen a woman as beautiful as you, ever, ever, really ever. But you know, we have this prayer, it's the Shema, and in the 3rd paragraph of the Shema, we mention these ritual fringes. And in that paragraph, twice, we say, I am the Lord your God. What does that mean? I am the Lord your God who rewards you. But the second, I am the Lord your God, I am the Lord your God who will punish you. I just can't do it. She grabs the boy and says, I'm not letting you go until you write down your name and where you're from and where you study Torah. Now, I have to say, when I teach this to my rabbinical students, this is the moment that they first, you'd think this would have been a long time ago, but this is the first moment they begin to think maybe this didn't really happen. because they cannot imagine any rabbinical student stupid enough to write down, you know, I'm at JTS, my dean is Danny Nevins. You know, like, who would do that? But this yutz does it, and he scampers out of there, and presumably, I can't totally sympathize, but enough I can sympathize to think he probably didn't tell anybody what happened, right? If anybody knew, he must have blustered. Okay. He's back at school, like, living down his ignominy, and she is so moved by the experience that she decides she's going to sell off everything and come and study Judaism. It's a fantasy, right? It's a rabbinic fantasy. She takes a third of her money and she gives it to the government, which is to say, she pays them off. She'd probably been bribing them to ply her trade for a long time. They realized they were going to lose a source of income, and so they simply took this bribe and looked the other way. A third of the money she gives to the poor. Now, for those of us who are Jews and Christians in the room, we are schooled in the art of charity. Of course you give money to the poor. But in the Roman world, in the pagan world, that did not happen. There was no ethos of giving. The super wealthy might give, but the very poor, it's as though they didn't exist. So the fact that she gives to the poor signals us that she's already on her way emotionally to converting. The last third she takes in her hand, and she goes, as the Midrash tells us, to the Beit Midrash, to the seminary of Rabbi Chiya. She gets there, and she says, Rabbi Chiya, convert me. Chiya looks her up and down again, and up and down a third time. He says, huh, maybe you saw one of the boys? She takes out the piece of paper with his name on it and hands it to Rabbi Chiya. Chiya calls the boy into his office. Now, just for a moment, put yourself in that boy's place. Right? You've been called by the dean, and you walk in the office, and there's the hooker. Oh my God. But Chiya says to him with a smile, you know, I know you refused it when it was forbidden. Now, you're going to teach her, you're going to convert her, and then you'll marry her and you'll have it when it's permitted. And then the Midrash comments on the story itself. It says, if this is the reward for the commandment of fringes in this world, I can't even begin to imagine the world to come. I love this story for a zillion reasons. But the one that, when I was writing, struck me is that it's really a story about the marriage, quite literally the marriage, of Judaism and Hellenism. Hellenism starts out incredibly attractive, but with a little bit of negative reputation, a hooker. And yet, not just any hooker, a fabulous hooker. And there's this awareness that Jews are buying their way in. That Jews want to be part of this. They want to engage. And in the narrative, at least, there is this assumption that the power of Jewish ethic is sufficient, that the power of Jewish commandments are sufficient, that ultimately we will convert Rome. In the end, there will be a marriage of Judaism and Hellenism, and they will live happily ever after. Thank you. Before we take questions, and I invite questions, I want to give a commercial. Elisa Braun is sitting in the back. Dr. Braun, please stand up. She is my boss, I guess. We are arranging a tour through JTS of Rome and the Galilee. We will visit the catacombs, we will visit the archaeological sites in Rome and in the Galilee, we will see the synagogues, we will see Aphrodite herself. This is from a floor in the Galilean city of Tsipori Sepphoris. We will go between May 21st and 29th. If you're interested in joining the tour, talk to Elisa. So get a look at her and you can find her later. So now that I've done the commercial for the tour, questions, comments, brief sermons, yes?
So I noticed that you're using the terms Greco and Roman interchangeably.
I am.
And so I'm wondering if, given the title of the talk, if your book deals at any point specifically with Roman culture.
So just a very, very quick thumbnail history. The Greeks, the question was Greco-Roman, what's Greek, what's Roman? And what's the relationship? So the Greeks, they were in before the Common Era. Alexander lived, let's say, around 325 BCE. He had a tutor, by the way, named Aristotle. Right? Good teacher if you can get him. And within 100, 120 years, the Greek Empire of Alexander the Great had been captured by the Romans. The Romans were rather staid, they were rather dull, and in the end, Greek culture overwhelmed the Roman Empire. The empire was still Roman, it was run by the Roman army, it was run by Roman emperors, it was run from Rome, but in the Eastern Mediterranean, for sure, the language and the culture was Greek. So we talk about Hellenism, which is very technically Greek culture, Hellene, Helen, like Helen of Troy, that's Greece. But we talk Greco-Roman because, in fact, the Jews of the land of Israel lived smack dab in the middle of the Roman Empire, where the culture was Greek, but it was Greek through the filter of the Roman Empire, Greco-Roman. Is that a good short answer?
Yeah, so it's not, I think there's nothing really abstract about Roman culture, per se, that is separate.
You can, but you have to read the book for that. Sir.
Do we have any idea of what proportion of the Jewish population at any time were really ardent followers of the rabbis and what proportion were they assimilated?
So the question is, how many Jews are assimilated, how many Jews followed the rabbis? You asked a very difficult question, and perhaps you know how difficult it is. And let me give you an analogy from now. I teach and train rabbinical students. And they actually believe that when they leave here and they go and serve a congregation, that people are going to care what they think. And part of my job is to disabuse them of that, that most Jews are not affiliated. We, you know, aren't necessarily observant. And I think the proportions depends on which scholar you're reading. The more observant the scholar is, the more likely they will tell you that there's a fairly high proportion of observance. Although I can think of one scholar just down the street at Columbia University who taught here for many, 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 many years, Seth Schwartz. And Seth wrote a very influential book in which he argued that from the time of the destruction of the temple in 70 until maybe the 3rd, 4th century with the advent of Christianity, Judaism was on the verge of dying out entirely. The only observant Jews were those few rabbis. Most of us think Seth is kind of extreme in his formulation. And in all fairness, Seth began his career at Yeshiva University, did his doctorate at Columbia, taught here for many years, and is now back at Columbia. I don't know whether that's a comment on his scholarship, his psyche, his, you know, parentage. But I mean, it's fascinating that you can find the whole gamut of opinion. And it's not, I guess, Seth being the exception here, it's not always tied to who you are and what your practice is, which is a very long way of answering your question, I don't know. Someone from this side of the room? Sir, please.
I'm curious if there's any noticeable impacts on the text of the Torah. I don't know how many biblical critics there are for this, but is there a detectable trace of Greco-Roman culture?
So, yes and no. The Torah text is an ancient Semitic document. It's transmitted in Hebrew, an ancient Semitic language. And usually when my scholar friends, who actually are Bible scholars, write about it, they are comparing the Torah text with texts from 1,000 years before the Common Era. That said, when the rabbis talk about the Bible, the whole Bible, the Tanakh, right, the Torah, the prophets, the writings, they more often than not invoke the 24 books of the Bible. So I dare say, go count them. You got to do some very creative mathematics to find only 24 books in the Bible. You have to count all 12 of the minor prophets as one book. You have to count First and Second Kings as one book. You have to count First and Second Samuel as one book, etc., etc. So why 24 books? What a coincidence, there's 24 books in the Iliad and 24 books in the Odyssey. So I think the rabbis occasionally wanted to say, you have sacred scripture, we have sacred scripture, and ours is like yours. But the actual text, much less so. Mayor. It's funny you ask that. They asked that in the first century. Mayor's question was, what's going to happen a couple of years from now? A couple of hundred years from now, will we still be here? And I think that's the perennial Jewish question. Will we still be here? The answer is, it's up to us, it's up to our children, it's up to our children's children. And we have asked this question for 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 years. It's the nature of who we are as a small minority among the large mass. We are a small minority, but the major religious cultures of the world, Christianity and Islam, are both derivative of Judaism. So in one form or another, one shape or another, we will be here. I'm staking my reputation on it. And we will be here as Jews. Will it look like this? I have no way of knowing. Depends on the architecture, depends on the country, depends on the custom, depends on the majority culture and religion that we find ourselves in. But we will still be here. Yes?
Will you now go into how big the meeting is in Alexander?
No. It's way too long and convoluted. And I ran into a problem. One of the chapters in the book is about the pervasiveness of Greek in rabbinic literature. And when I sat down to write it, I realized, well, okay, I know Hebrew, I know Aramaic, I know Greek, I know Latin. How do I write this in English so that readers who know none of the above can follow the argument? It took a lot of unpacking, and I have to say, I have an editor, Sandy will attest to it, she drove me nuts. I came home grumbling day after day after day. I have never revised a book as much as I revised this book. Because her mantra was, Bert, it's too academic. And my response was always, but Elizabeth, I'm an academic. And Elizabeth would say, yeah, but I'm a bookseller. I want people to read this book. And so she really pushed me to do it. So even in the book, I don't give the long explanation because it was just way too technical. So, Tammy. Please.
That is that Alexander the Great was seen by some Jews as the savior of the Jewish and supposedly there were all these exchanges between Jewish leaders and community and Alexander.
Yes, there are stories in the Midrash and in the Talmud about Alexander the Great. The same stories that were told by Christians about Alexander the Great and by pagans. There was a cycle, it's called the Alexander legends. And we told them too. Alexander was a big deal. So we have time for, Tammy is a professor of classics, so I defer to her. Sir, last question.
The relationship of the rabbis to their Roman political and religious authorities.
The relationship of the rabbi to the Roman political and religious authorities. It depends on the rabbi. There's a very famous story in the Talmud. It's in the Babylonian Talmud tractate Shabbat 33b. I happen to write about it today. In which one rabbi says, how great are the Romans? They build markets. They build roads. They build this. They build that. And another rabbi responds, yeah. They build markets so their whores have a place to ply their trade. They build roads so that they can collect taxes. Right? So these are two rabbinic colleagues with very different attitudes about how to read Rome. I really think it depends who you are, how comfortable you are in the world, how educated you may or may not be. We have evidence, it's a little bit debated, but mostly accepted, that the head of the Jewish community in the land of Israel, in the 4th, 5th century, sent his son up to Antioch to learn from Libanius, the great professor of rhetoric. It's an interesting story because the kid apparently took the money and went on a road trip. And the only reason we know about it is Libanius had the unfortunate task of writing the father, the head of the Jewish community. He's a good boy. I'm sure he's okay. I'm sure he's getting a good education, traveling, but he's not here. But it's evidence that within the upper crust, if you will, of rabbinic leadership, there were rabbis who were very content to be part and parcel of the Roman Empire. David, you want to say an afterword?
Yes, I do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bert. That's obviously just a small taste of what you'll find in the book. So now is the occasion to have some refreshment, have an opportunity to buy the book, $20, either cash or pay to the order of the author. I just want to indicate we'll be taking a break now of book talks for the next month because Rosh Hashanah is coming and we've got a lot of holidays. But thereafter, we will resume this schedule on November 2nd. Beth Kisilev will be speaking about her book, Reading Genesis, Beginning. So you're invited back for that. And hopefully we've got your emails. We will notify you of future book talks to come. The last thing I have to say is I wish you all a good, healthy, and in all respects, wonderful New Year. Shana Tova.